seminar called Effective Writing for Superfund Staff, Community Involvement Plans and Beyond. Today's class is sponsored by Cluin, and it's also sponsored by the Superfund Community Involvement University. My name is Yolanda Sanchez, and I'm a new Community Involvement Coordinator in Region 9. Some of you may know me from my former role at headquarters in the Superfund Program's Community Involvement and Program Initiatives branch. I moved out west, and I'm very happy to be here. I will be moderating today's webinar, as well as providing some of the instruction. I'd like to invite the other instructor, Kay Morrison, to introduce herself.
Thanks, Yolanda. I've been a Community Involvement Coordinator in Region 10 for about 4 years now. I work on Superfund sites in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, and I support the region with their social media efforts as well.
Before we start the presentation, I'd like to go over a few participation guidelines. Note that we have muted the phone lines. However, we still want you to be an active participant. If you have a question at any time, use the Q&A pod or raise your virtual hand by using the status indicator on the top of your webinar screen. The status indicator is a little person with their hand raised. We will have a number of polls and short answer questions throughout the training, so please be present. If you must step away at any time, change your status indicator, again, the little person with their hand raised at the top of the computer. This way, we won't call on you while you've stepped away. Finally, be aware that this event is being recorded. It will be shared via email shortly after the live delivery, and we'll place it on an online archive, which can be accessed for free using the same URL you used to join us today. Let's briefly review the features of this virtual classroom. In addition to the main section that contains the presentation slides, we will also be able to interact. We will be using polls to ask you for your feedback throughout the session. So let's go ahead and give it a try. In the poll on the screen, which asks the question, how familiar are you with community involvement plans? Please select the most appropriate response. The responses range from you've never heard of a community involvement plan to you've heard your colleagues discuss what these things are, you've skimmed the community involvement plan, you've written one, or you've participated in training, or you're a master CIC and you've authored 3 or more community involvement plans. We have some responses rolling in. Well, it looks like a bell curve going on where most people have skimmed the community involvement plan. At least everyone has heard of them on the training, which is wonderful. And we have about 4 master community involvement coordinators on the call. So thank you for joining us, and we might be using your expertise throughout the training. Remember, if you have a question or comment for the instructors, or if you wish to report technical issues, please type it in the Q&A pod, which is located at the right side of the screen. This will be available throughout the webinar. And please note that we will also be using the award-winning Tuba City Dump Community Involvement Plan as an example of effective organization, formatting, and writing techniques. We'll be using it in several times throughout the course. You can download that Community Involvement Plan by clicking the link in the related URLs pod in the lower right-hand corner. Now, I'd like to pass the virtual microphone to Kay to review the learning objectives for today's session.
Thanks, Yolanda. The purpose of this webinar is to provide you with some of the information required to write clear, concise, organized, and effective public documents, including community involvement plans, as well as other public documents. Most of the class will focus on writing and formatting techniques that can be applied to all documents. To support that purpose, I'll make 4 main points. I'll review the main purpose and audiences of documents written for communities affected by Superfund sites. I'll talk about how to organize effective public documents. We'll look at incorporating formatting techniques in public documents to enhance their scannability. And I'll talk about using good writing techniques to enhance the clarity and effectiveness of any public document. Okay, let's get started.
The purpose and audience drive the content and style of your public documents. Please, well, let's start, sorry, by considering community involvement plans. Please use the poll. What do you think the purpose of a community involvement plan is? You can respond to the short answer poll only one time, so make sure you submit a good answer. Again, you can respond to the poll by typing your short answer in the text box under the question, what is the purpose of a community involvement plan? You can hit enter after you've typed in your response, or the little cartoon bubble to the right of the text box. We've got some responses rolling in. The purpose of a community involvement plan is to outline how you will communicate with the local community for a Superfund site. Absolutely. It helps EPA in learning the best ways to engage and communicate with the local community. Definitely. A plan will help, will show you how you will communicate with the community for a project. CIPs provide an overview of EPA's planned activities, absolutely. To involve the community in EPA's plan of engagement, definitely. Lots of great answers rolling in. And more answers keep coming. So the purpose of community involvement plans, these are all definitely on track. A specific plan to guide the remedial project managers on how to communicate and participate with the community. I really like that answer. A lot of times we have to think about many times community involvement coordinators are authoring the plans, but it's a team effort, and it's really to provide some instruction and help for the other team members, like the remedial project manager and other folks on engagement. Inform the community of how they can participate? Yes. Kay, are there some answers that kind of pop out for you?
Yeah, well, I agree with you that the site-specific plan for RPMs is very interesting. And I think all of these are really on track for the purpose of the community involvement plan.
Well, thank everyone for participating and getting us started. And I'd like to turn it over again to Kay to give us a full understanding of the purpose of a community.
Right. Thanks, everybody, for those great responses. According to EPA's Community Involvement Plans Toolkit, a well-written community involvement plan enables community members affected by a Superfund site to understand the ways in which they can participate in decision-making throughout the cleanup process. It's generally not to provide technical answers to the community's questions. The community involvement plan is EPA's plan for informing and involving the community in the cleanup process. Avoid including content that does not serve that purpose or does not help readers understand the purpose of the community involvement plan. It's not only about what we want to say or how to protect EPA's interests. It's also about what the readers need and want to know. The CIP should help the community members understand the Superfund cleanup process, how, when, and where EPA will provide site-related information, how the public can be actively involved in the cleanup process, and the key points in the cleanup process and the ways in which EPA takes public input into consideration during the interim and final decisions. So who are these readers? The primary audience of the community involvement plan is the community. While there are a number of EPA employees who are also likely to read the CIP, the target audience is the community affected by the Superfund site. You should have a fairly good understanding of the community you're writing for after doing interviews with community members in preparation for writing the CIP. You'll be writing your community involvement plan with community members in mind.
Now that Kay has reviewed the purpose and the audience of the community involvement plan, let's discuss how to organize effective CIPs as well as other public documents. When you organize your public documents, focus on four things to enhance their effectiveness. First, focus on content that serves your purpose. If the content does not serve your purpose, then don't include it. Remember, less is more. Second, focus on the audience's needs. What does the audience need to know, and what does the audience need to do? What are the most important points for your community to understand? Third, put first things first. Include the most important information, what the community needs to know and do, early in your document, and push back the other information. Or if you're writing a fact sheet, emphasize the most important information separate from the other text. And fourth, map your messages. Outline your document content to ensure it serves your purpose and your key points. Now Kay will explain these points in further detail.
By focus on your audience's needs, we mean include information that helps them understand what they will want to know and do, but not distracting or unnecessary details. Think about answering questions that you can reasonably assume your readers will have. You may need to consider the various audiences, because different groups within the community might want to know and do different things. For example, workers who used to be employed by the potentially responsible party might require different information than healthcare providers. Remember the document's purpose. If your written document is clear and compelling for the community, it will be clear and compelling to more technical audiences. In addition, you want to put first things first. Place the most important information first. The most important information in a community involvement plan, from the perspective of community members, should determine the chapter or section headings you use. Other types of information may be more appropriate for appendices. The same will be true for other public documents. Consider your audience and what they'll want to know or do. A fact sheet, for example, might start with what's happening at the site right now, followed by what work was recently completed, and what's coming up in the next field season, who to contact if you have questions, and then background about the site itself. If it's a fact sheet announcing a proposed plan, it might start with the opening and closing dates for the comment period, followed by dates of public meetings or information sessions, followed by a summary of the plan, followed by background of the site. Each document should be tailored to the audience and the topic. Message mapping is one technique to ensure you focus on the audience and include only information the audience requires. Determine your key messages based on community needs and support each key message with a limited number of supporting details. Try to write the key messages so they're easy to understand and easy to remember. There will be messages, of course, that we as the agency need to convey to the community. But limit the number of messages in your written documents and stick to what the audience needs to know and do. As you know, messages to the community will change over time. Mapping them out at key junctures or milestones in the cleanup process will provide a good structure for your communication strategies, fact sheets, community involvement plan revisions, and other communication methods. It will also show that EPA continues to pay attention to community concerns. Next, I'd like to talk about formatting techniques you might use to make your documents more effective and improve their scannability. First, use a cover page that's attractive to your audience. Notice that these two examples on screen, with their color photographs, appear so much more appealing, interesting, and inviting than a plain white cover page that includes only text. Using a photo of the site on the cover, and where possible throughout the document, will show the reader that you understand where they live and what needs to be protected. Include an EPA logo or seal on any official document you provide to the public. Make sure you follow the agency's guidance and use the files available on the EPA Stylebook website. You can find this link called EPA Guidance on Using EPA Seal and Logo in the related URLs pod on the bottom right side of the screen. For longer documents, use a simple table of contents up front so readers know what information is in the document and how to find it. Remember that chapter and section titles should convey complete thoughts. Consider adding color tabbing or other visual cues that help readers quickly find the sections of the document they're interested in. These two examples provide two different ways of depicting a table of contents. The example on the left from the Tuba City Dump CIP shows the readers at a glance that there are four sections and shows their titles in large print. each highlighted with a different color that's carried to the CIP via tabs to make it easier for readers to differentiate the sections and associate content with the corresponding section. It also provides a brief description of the content in each section and the page number that begins each section. The second example on the right is the first page of the Iron King Mine CIP, which is a more standard table of contents. Like the other example, this shows the section headings and page numbers, but this example also provides significantly more detail about the specific contents and their page numbers. Neither of these is better than the other, but just by glancing at the table of contents, each sets a different tone for the reader. When writing for your site's community, it's important to be cognizant of that tone and choose what is most effective for your audience. And as we mentioned during the organizational portion of the webinar, use appendices to move necessary background information to the back of the document. Details about the site history, contaminant exposure information, glossary, acronyms, and abbreviations, media contacts, cleanup funding information, and other necessary background information may appear in the Community Involvement Plan's appendices.
I'd like to invite everyone to participate in an activity about using effective headings and subheadings. In the short answer poll on the screen, please share your thoughts about what makes the headings effective in this excerpt from the Tuba City Dump CIP that's on the screen right now. Remember, you can respond only one time. We've got some responses rolling in. Red text, yes, using a different color font makes it easier to read, and it pops that heading out from the rest of the text. There's succinct titles, short titles, use of color, and underlining. That underline under those major headings helps kind of section the text into different places. Some people like the template. They're brief. They're bold. Yes, using a different font is helpful when headings and subheadings. Lots of really great answers coming in. Use of white space, someone mentioned. We'll be going over that a little bit later. All the headings are in the same format. It's nice, isn't it? It helps the flow of the document when you have the same format for the headings. It makes it easier for the audience to take in. They're brief and easy to scan. Lots of great answers coming in. Use of color. And I know a lot of times we have a hard time using color in our documents, but just bolding it or giving it just a different look and feel than the rest of the document will help that heading stand out. So really great examples. The headings are easy to locate. They're in a different color. The font and size are different than the body text. There's ample space above the subheadings that separate them from the previous content, and very little space between the subheadings and the related content that follows it. The headers break up the text into manageable but meaningful bits of information. For example, we can easily find the information on newspaper communication by quickly scanning the document.
And importantly, the words that make up the headings and the subheadings convey complete thoughts. As readers, we aren't left wondering what they mean. We know immediately that this information applies to the Navajo community members affected by the site, and we know at a glance where to find important information.
And Kay, before you move on, someone did mention that, you know, do we need to be careful with colors? Sometimes people can't print, or sometimes we have a colorblind audience, so we have to be careful with the colors that we use in those throughout our documents.
That's exactly right. In addition, use white space effectively. One of you commented already about white space. This example shows a page with a lot of text that still effectively uses white space, especially in the margins, between the columns, and between headings, subheadings, and the text associated with each. Effective use of white space makes the text easier to read, less cramped, and less overwhelming. It also gives your document a more polished, professional appearance. Even if it makes the document slightly longer, with the effective use of white space, it will be easier to read than a shorter document that does not use white space effectively. Many professional graphic designers recommend between 10 to 35% of blank space for print materials. A good rule of thumb is to leave at least a half inch to an inch of blank space around the margins of the page. An additional formatting technique that makes it easier for readers to engage with the content is to present a complete message on one page or two facing pages. It's easy to forget the first part of a message if the reader must turn the page in the middle of it. In this example from the Tuba City Dump CIP, the entire timing of community involvement activities section appears within these two facing pages. The reader can focus on the information for the length of these two pages and then literally turn the page and focus on the next topic. Refer to the Tuba City Dump CIP after the webinar to review this further.
We'd like to invite you to participate in another activity poll. Which of the formatting techniques that Cave discussed today are new techniques for you? So far, we've covered using an attractive CIP cover page, using a simple table of contents up front, using appendices to move background information to the back of a document, using effective headings and subheadings, including white space, and also we've discussed presenting a complete message on one page or two facing pages. Feel free to select as many answers that apply. Well, it's great. It looks like we introduced some new content to everyone today, Kay. Lots of folks kind of, it's a new idea to use an attractive CIP cover page that invites the audience in. It looks like including white space is a new topic. And I know, you know, we struggle with that, keeping documents short and also including white space, but it's really helpful for your reader to include an ample amount of white space, even if it lengthens the document. And the idea of presenting a complete message on one page or two facing pages, I think that's really great that we've been able to introduce that topic today as well.
I agree. I'm really happy that the information that we're presenting is, you know, both new and hopefully useful. On the next slide, I want to show you something that's not easy to read. It's what we call... Come on. I think you've all seen something like this.
And the anticipation's killing them.
It's exciting. It's the wall of words. Let me give you a few seconds to scan this. And then on the next slide, you'll see that there's a simple table that contains the same information describing the estimated dose of arsenic for children. It highlights exposure to children with soil pica behavior, which is actually eating the soil. The way this table shows several locations with different average arsenic levels is much easier to read. It's easier for a number of reasons. You can find the information you need without having to sort through a long passage of text, which in this case contains a lot of similar words and phrases. It clarifies the information and presents it in a way that's easy to digest. Use tables to explain complex relationships or logic paths. Tables can be powerful. They can make it easy to take in complex information at a glance. They can make it easy to locate specific information, and they can make your logic and structure clear. But one note of caution, be aware that tables may provide difficulty for low literacy audiences. If you're going to use them, make sure they're very clear.
In addition, don't use a table just to use a table. If a table is unclear, your documents will be less effective. In fact, let's explore changes that would make the table on the screen more effective. Please type your responses into the short answer poll. And remember, you can only respond one time. Consistent font would definitely help the reader with the table. Correct spelling, that's one that, you know, hits us every once in a while. Using bullets, a consistent title and headings would help this table be easier to read. Lots of great answers coming in. Color, headings, spelling again. Keep them coming. There's lots of different answers to this question. Removing the lines, yes, that's right. It might make this table easier to read by grouping the information together. Using bold font to differentiate maybe the headers or the subheaders in the information. Great, really good answers. And in the next slide, we will take a peek at a revised version of this table. Obviously, there's many ways to revise this table, as you have all noted. But here is the same information presented in a different way. We've added a title. Your table should always be able to stand on their own for readers. A title is always important. We also differentiated that title from the rest of the table by shading the cell. We categorized the information so it's easier on the readers, and we differentiated the categories from the information in the categories by using the bold font. Remember, tables should always clarify information for the readers. And I'll turn it over to Kay to further explain this.
Yeah, let's review the effective table from earlier in this topic. This table is effective because it clarifies the content. The header, or top row, tells us what the content is for each cell underneath. We know to locate average arsenic soil levels in the left column, and to find whether there are associated health concerns in the column on the right. The use of differently shaded rows makes it easier to associate the content from each cell in the same row. And on the next slide, we think about a risk communication perspective. And it's always helpful to give the audience specific things to do. We can add a column with protective options to the table without making the table too busy. Another effective way of avoiding a wall of words in your document is using short lists. They break up the text and make it easier for the reader to identify items or steps. They also add white space. Create lists of 3 to 7 items using bullets or numbers. Shorter, bulleted lists are easier to scan and easier for people with limited reading skills to understand. The sample on the left side of the screen shows a larger selection, public notification process, with a bulleted list of public participation opportunities. Use numbers or letters rather than bullet symbols in your list when you want to imply a chronology or a ranking of importance. The sample list of other public events on the right of the screen contains items listed with letters. The Tuba City Flea Market occurs more frequently and is more targeted to the specific community affected by the Superfund site than other listed items, so it appears first on the list. Use bullets, as in the example on the left of the screen, unless you need to show chronology or ranking order. Now, Yolanda will talk about another writing tip.
Make sure that all of the list items are in parallel structure. Parallel structure means that you use similar patterns or words or grammatical forms to express related ideas. Parallel structure creates rhythm and balance to your message. Obviously, this is a super exaggerated example, but we can explore other examples that hit closer to home. Here is an example of a list in a non-parallel structure. This list lacks rhythm and flow. We can pull apart the first bullet to make 2 bullets that have parallel structure with the third bullet. There we go. But the last bullet in this list is still a bit awkward to read. So I'm going to go to another activity poll, and I'll ask you as the audience, what changes would make this last bullet in a parallel structure to the rest of the list? Please type your response in the short answer poll. And remember, you can only respond once. We got some great answers rolling in. Yep, there we go. Start with a verb, that's right. Start with an active verb. Attend the community meeting on February 1st. Attend the public meeting. Yep, I think everyone understands that for this list to be in parallel structure, it makes sense to start with an active verb on the fourth bullet now. So obviously there are many correct answers to this poll. And one way that we did it, if we go to the next slide, is including a command verb at the beginning. We chose to say, participate in the community meeting. But there were lots of correct answers on the poll.
Another formatting technique is to use text boxes and graphics to highlight important information. Text boxes can make it easier to find the most important information on the page. The Iron King Mine Community Involvement Plan uses text boxes effectively. In the example on the left, the text box highlights contaminants found at the Superfund site. In the example on the right, we see the U.S. EPA contacts and site repositories, as well as the location and contact information for both. The reader does not have to go searching for this very important information. Be sure your graphics tell a complete story. They should be able to stand on their own the way tables do. They should be meaningful and serve a purpose. In this example, the use of the pie charts is not ineffective on its own, but the information included on these pie charts is incomplete. We don't know the relationship between the two pie charts, and there's no accompanying text to help clarify this relationship. In this slide, we see another approach to presenting the same information. We include a title to help explain the relationship between the two pie charts. We also make the text in the pie charts less busy for the reader. The point we want to impress is that adding graphics should add value to your document. Photographs may help certain audiences identify with your messages. It can be good to include photos of community members participating in site-related activities. Select images that are familiar and to which the audience can relate. The images should serve a purpose. In these examples on the screen, the photograph on the left from the Tuba City Dump Community Involvement Plan shows US EPA and Navajo Nation EPA staff at a public event. The photograph on the right from the Hudson Community Involvement Plan shows community members participating in a meeting with EPA staff. The map graphic in the center of the screen illustrates the Tuba City Dump Superfund site and the area that surrounds it using local roads and markers such as the Navajo and Hopi boundaries and local stores to help orient the audience. When you use maps and photographs, be sure to label them with captions. Some people may read only your captions if they skim through a document. That makes them an ideal place to include your key messages. Use brief completes with correct punctuation. While it's good to use photographs of people and locations that are familiar to your readers, be sure you have permission to use the pictures of the people in the photos. You should always have explicit permission from a parent or guardian to use photos of children. And while you may not be legally required to get permission to take photos in a public space, it's best practice to ask anyway. Ask the people taking photos for you to save them at high resolution so the person formatting your document has the best picture to work with. Avoid using stock photos or pictures of places that are not part of the site. I love this photo. It's great because it's interesting and funny, but it has a couple of problems. If the photographer had moved slightly to the right or left, the placement of the light pole might be less unfortunate. There also appears to be water spots or fingerprints on the lens, creating a slight blur in the lower half of the picture. Try to get good photos, that is, pictures that are in focus and with no distracting or unnecessary elements every time you or someone on the technical team goes to the site. And text appearance matters. The way your text looks greatly affects readability. In the same way that your nonverbal communication can affect your message in a face-to-face interaction, the appearance of your text can affect your typed message. Here are some rules of thumb for those of us who don't have the luxury of a designer to format our documents. Use font sizes between 12 and 14 points for body text. Anything less than 12 points can be too small to read for many audiences. Older people and people who have trouble reading or seeing may need larger print. For headings, use a font size at least 2 points larger than the body size text. Body text size, sorry. For the body of the text, use fonts with serifs, like the body text in this example. Serifs are the little feet on the letters. In print material, serif fonts are often easier to read. The word serif on the screen appears in Times New Roman, a serif font. In contrast, the blue text on the screen, sans serif, appears in Arial, a common sans serif font. The body of the text in the Tuba City Dump CIP example appears in a serif font. For headings and subheadings, use sans serif fonts. Text in a sans serif font can be more readable on a computer screen or when your type must be small. The headings and subheadings in the Tuba City Dump CIP example are in a sans serif font. Keep the following additional style tips in mind. Do not use fancy or script lettering. It's distracting and may appear unprofessional. Use both upper and lowercase letters. Despite many of the examples in this presentation, don't use all caps. They're harder to read. Use bold type to emphasize words or phrases. Limit the use of italics or underlining. They're harder to read, and underlining has come to imply web links. Use dark letters on a light background. Light text on dark backgrounds is harder to read, especially if it's a large amount of text, plus it will use a lot of ink to print. Also, use columns to format and break up text. In a document with a portrait or vertical orientation, a two-column format is an effective way to break up content and make it easier to read. These two examples are from a long fact sheet on the Upper Columbia River Superfund site. The columns on the left page are clearly divided by headings. The page on the right shows both a two-column format, the bottom half of the page, and a section that spans both columns. Because the photo is large and the text is sectioned into bullets, trying to impose two columns under this section would make the text much harder to read. And incorporating good writing techniques will enhance the clarity and effectiveness of all your written documents. We'll cover a few of the most... Yes?
Before you move on, we did have one person raise their hand. So, Miriam, I don't know if you wanted to type your question in the Q&A pod or is there something that you wanted to say on the phone?
I'm happy to.
And if you're on the phone, you press #6 to come off mute.
Yep.
Well, she typed a question in Q&A, so I'll go ahead and answer that while you move forward with writing techniques.
Okay, thanks, Yolanda. Incorporating good writing techniques will enhance the clarity and effectiveness of all your written documents. We'll cover a few of the most salient writing techniques to use, but take a look at the EPA Communications Style Book for more information.
Before we move on to our next writing technique, let's take a poll to start our conversation on the use of active versus passive voice. There are two sentences on your screen. Which of the two sentences is an active voice? The first one is, the Office of Water Volunteers cleaned up the Anacostia River. And the second sentence is, the Anacostia River was cleaned up. Lots of answers coming in. Someone decided to change their answer when they saw that most participants had the first one answered, which is correct. The active sentence of the two is the first one. The Office of Water Volunteers cleaned up the Anacostia River. But it's not surprising, actually, that people have difficulty with this exercise. Using passive voice is entrenched in government documents. Passive voice is always how many of us scientists were trained to write. But passive voice is difficult for the audience to connect who is doing the action in the sentence. The second sentence in this example fails to identify who cleaned up the river, and that's an important message. Kay will further explain that.
Right. In the active voice is the subject of the sentence who does the action. In general, sentences in the active voice are more interesting, easier to understand, and less prone to awkward sentence construction. In addition, the actor is less likely to be left out of the sentence in the active voice than in the passive voice. To illustrate this, let's take a look at these examples. The first sentence, a group of public meetings were facilitated by EPA for the community in regards to the remedial action for the site, is in passive voice. The sentence has been rewritten in active voice. EPA facilitated a group of public meetings. Notice in both sentences that EPA is the subject of the action and highlighted in green text. The action facilitated appears in orange in both sentences. And the receiver of the action, a group of public meetings, appears in blue in both sentences. These two sentences are noticeably different. In the active voice sentence, the subject of the sentence, EPA, is also the subject of the action, and it appears in the beginning of the sentence. Active voice sentences typically use fewer words. The passive voice sentences require extra words to make it work, like by, were, and in regards to, rather than regarding. Let's look at this a little more.
In this sentence on the screen, community involvement has been established by EPA since the discovery of the site. Please identify the subject or who does the action using the poll on the screen. And lots of answers coming in. Some people shifting answers. That's right. The EPA is the subject of the action or the subject of the sentence. In the same example, let's try another question. What is the action or the verb in the sentence? The verb or the action of the sentence is establish or has been established. And one more question on this sentence. Can you identify the receiver of that action? That's right. For most people, community involvement is the receiver of that action. So this is really important because it's really useful for the audience, for you all to keep the subject and the verb and the receiver very close together in the sentence because it's easier for people to read and understand. So we'll move to a rewritten version of the sentence. And we've rewritten it to say, EPA has established community involvement since the discovery of the site. So here we have the subject, EPA, right next to the verb, has established, which is followed by the receiver, community involvement. And the flow of the sentence is easier for audiences to read. Because writing in passive voice is so entrenched in many professionals' writing style, let's rewrite one more sentence before we move on. Take a moment to enter a rewritten version of this long sentence. The original sentence reads, several public meetings were held to discuss the status of the site's remedial action plan over the period of the site's existence. Remember, you can respond one time, so we'll give you 30 to 40 seconds to respond. We have some answers coming in, but I know a lot of folks are participating in the poll, so we'll give everyone about 20 more seconds to try to rewrite the sentence in active voice. Right, lots of really different and correct answers rolling in. In fact, some people just rewrote the sentence entirely, which is another great way to solve the problem. Just do 5 more seconds while people get their final answers in. And these are some answers that we haven't even thought about, okay? But they seem great because they have the subject and the verb right next to each other.
Exactly.
So our revision to the sentence, we'll show on the same slide, is that EPA held several public meetings to discuss the status of the site's remedial action plan over the period of the site's existence. And some folks chose to have the preposition over the period of the site's existence at the beginning of the sentence, which reads just fine too. Just remember to try to keep your subject, your verb, and your receiver close together. And Heriberto, I see that you raised your hand. If you're on the phone, you can press *6 to ask your question, or you can put it in the Q&A pod, and I will try to respond to it right now.
And while we wait for that question to show up, I did want to comment that I like the one of the rewritten sentences says, we held public meetings, and I love the use of we whenever we can. It's less formal. It makes EPA the people that you know, do the work.
And that's really important in our community involvement plans because they are documents where we're trying to establish a relationship. So you're right, Kay. I love the way that we can use we when we're speaking to our public. And again, Heriberto, if you're on the phone, like, just press #6 and you should be able to ask your question. Or if you're on the computer, just type it into the Q&A pad and I'll try to respond.
Meanwhile, let's move ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Just as in the previous example, keep the subject and the verb close together in the sentence. In professional writing, many of us have the habit of inserting prepositional phrase after prepositional phrase. The Tuba City Dump Community Involvement Plan provides a good example of keeping the subject and the verb together. Let's consider this brief excerpt. Navajo Nation EPA representatives respectfully requested that EPA not conduct interviews with Navajo residents, because many of the Navajo residents had been interviewed by Navajo Nation EPA and US EPA for site history information. Compare that to how it could have been. Navajo Nation EPA representatives, comma, due to the fact that many of the Navajo residents had been previously interviewed by Navajo Nation EPA and US EPA for site history information, comma, respectfully requested that US EPA not conduct interviews with Navajo residents. Notice how far apart the subject and the verb are. Although neither sentence is incorrect, they both express the same idea, keeping subject, Navajo Nation EPA representatives, and the verb requested close together, as in the first example, makes the idea presented much easier to understand. In addition, try to keep it short. This applies to words, sentences, sections, and the document as a whole. Use words with 1 or 2 syllables when you can. Keep most sentences, if possible, between 8 to 10 words, and limit paragraphs to 3 to 5 sentences. Vary your sentence length, but aim for short sentences. If you can't avoid a long sentence, insert much shorter ones before and after the long sentence. Your primary job as a writer is to ensure that your reader understands your message. To some extent, the sheer discipline of trying to write short sentences will help you make them concise. There's nothing inherently confusing about a compound or complex sentence, but if a thought or thought sequence can be expressed in simple sentences, it's easier to follow. Okay, just a few more points. This one, highlight the positive. One way to do so is to use an encouraging tone. Emphasize practical actions. Offer concrete examples of steps people can take. If it would be useful, you can suggest where the reader might learn more about a topic. Be aware that you're not talking down or preaching to your audience. People are less likely to continue reading or listening to you or act on information if they're made to feel bad about their current situation. In this example, we highlight the positive by telling the reader what they should do rather than what they should not do. Leave the valve open is a more positive way of saying do not close the valve. And turn the water off is a more positive way of saying, don't leave the water running. In addition, limit the use of jargon, technical, or scientific language. Jargon is techno-talk. Shop talk, stylized forms of bad grammar which can be off-putting and seem pretentious to the reader. Most jargon is a kind of shorthand we use to communicate with others in the same field. It's exclusive in nature and likely to cause confusion in a public document. Make sure the words you're using are in common usage. For example, if you use the word dose to refer to an exposure, the lay reader can reasonably assume that it's a good thing. A dose of medicine, after all, is the first two entries in the dictionary definition of dose. Avoid unnecessary abbreviations and acronyms. Sometimes they're very helpful, so don't eliminate them entirely. However, be sure acronyms are spelled out the first time they appear. Since 2010, the law requires that federal agencies use clear government communication that the public can understand and use. Plainlanguage.gov is a website with many helpful and sometimes funny tips, guidance, examples, and it provides several forms of training. And finally, to avoid confusion, be consistent with your word use. For example, be mindful when you refer to the CIP as the plan or the strategy. These are similar terms, and you may choose to use one or the other, but using them interchangeably in your community involvement plan may be confusing. You can use pollution versus contamination, or substances, or contaminants. In addition, you should be aware that the public may not distinguish between common EPA phrases, even when you use the words consistently, such as community involvement plan, community involvement action plan, community involvement issues, and community involvement tools. If you really need to use each of these terms in one document, be sure you include them in a glossary and avoid inconsistent use to limit confusion. Better yet, think of phrases that community members would say when describing those things and use the phrases consistently. You're lucky if your audience has a good editor that can review your document for grammar, punctuation, and consistency. If not, consider asking an EPA colleague to review your documents specifically for the use of consistent terms and acronyms. It's best if that person has little connection with the material.
Well, I can't believe it happened so quickly, but at this point, we've reached the end of the prepared portion of the webinar. Although we had a lot of great questions and answers come throughout the webinar that we were able to respond to, I know that folks might have some additional questions to ask the two presenters. So please, at this time, use the Q&A pod to ask any questions that you might have or to share some thoughts you might have on the writing, formatting, and other techniques that we've talked about today. I know, John, one of the comments you had was really about the use of color and working with folks who might have issues using the color, and you had some other suggestions that I'd love to hear. So if you're on the phone, feel free to press #6 to talk about those suggestions, or you could type it into the Q&A pad, and I'll share it with the rest of the classroom. So again, you can ask your question by going to the right portion of your screen, Q&A pod. We have one question coming in. When using color in a document, are there colors to avoid? That's a great question. Again, if someone has a little more information on working with folks who have limited ability for reading color to chime in on the answer to that question, I'd appreciate it.
I do. Yeah. I have a couple of thoughts about that. There are web pages that you can go to read more about colorblindness, but I think in every instance, you want to be careful to make sure that color isn't the only way you're conveying information. So make sure that there's a lot of contrast in the colors that you choose so that if people end up, say, printing the document in black and white, or if they can't see those colors, they'll still get the message that you're trying to get across. So you do need to be careful about the way you use color. If color is the only way to present information, you need to also provide enough text description so that people who can't see those colors will understand that there is a distinction that you're making. So it's a little bit complicated, but as long as you just keep in mind that there are, you know, colorblind readers, then that's going to help you.
And then while you were talking, Kay, John shared a URL that's on our internet page that can help people with that question, too. So I'm going to share it with the rest of the class as well. And we'll make sure we pop that URL onto our related URLs page so everyone can access it after the webinar.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. Thanks, John.
Another question that came up that I will speak to, and in the meantime, Kay, I assigned you another question to think about. But Pamela asked a question. Is there a standard community involvement plan that is uniform for each region to use as a place to start? And Pamela, about 3 years ago, I chaired the work group who developed our community involvement plan tool in the Superfund Community Involvement Plan Toolkit. And we actually made a decision not to include a standard CIP template because we felt like people were using it a little more as a crutch. And we understand that each site is unique, and each community is unique as well, and trying to get people to understand that they should write their CIPs in a way that best suits their audience. However, there are a lot of really great examples that you could look at to get an idea of how you might want to start where your CIP is. So in the related URLs pod on the bottom of the screen, there's a link to the CIP tool. And the CIP tool kind of goes over your standard sections that you should have in a community involvement plan. And we have some links to really great community involvement plans that other folks have written as well. So I encourage you to take a look at that. And also, someone asked me if there was a Word version of the Tuba City Dump CIP. Larry, you can email me, sanchez.yolanda@epa.gov, and I'll check with the Region 9 staff to see if they have a Word version of that CIP. So Kay, David asked the question whether we should avoid at all costs the use of the term remediation, remedy, and remedial action. And I know you have some opinions on this, so I'm going to hand that over to you.
I do. Thank you. You know, I have strong opinions about it, but it's really hard to say avoid at all costs. I would like to see us use the most plain words for the things that we're doing, you know, when we're communicating with the public. But because our technical staff is often going to say remediation, remedy, and remedial action, it's helpful to include them in a glossary of sorts. You know, for community involvement plans, there's probably no need to use remediation. But as you get into more technical documents or fact sheets or things that you're going to hand out at a public meeting when the technical staff is likely to use those terms, you do want to make sure that plain language definitions of that kind of terminology, and there are a lot of those kinds of things that we use. You know, it is jargon, it is shorthand, you know, it is the way that we talk about things, but sometimes it's the most precise way of talking about it. So when that's the case, you do want to make sure you've got a plain language definition. I wish I could say you have to avoid that at all costs. But, you know, we try to do the best we can.
Another question that came in is that Romy asked, is there a general or basic appendix or glossary that's available for community involvement plans? I think that's a great question, and I wish I had a good answer for it. What I will assign myself to do is look for a basic glossary that have been used in the past and then try to email that out to the folks who joined the webinar today or add it to the related references page for the website, for this classroom. But I don't know, Kay, I'm sure Region 10 has one that you guys pass around to your CICs that we could share with people as well.
You know, we probably do, but I'm tempted to send people to that plainlanguage.gov website because they have a lot of examples, and they also have people that you can, you know, ask if you're really stuck. You know, they've got sort of the plain language chops that some of the rest of us might not have. So that's another option for people to get that kind of glossary information.
You know, someone also mentioned the comments on a question, but that they avoid using color printing for cost purposes, which makes complete sense. Mm-hmm. And usually the document is printed in grayscale, but then they go ahead and upload that onto the website in color. So when you're formatting a document, you definitely want to be aware of how it might look when it's printed out in grayscale and how it's going to look online using color. So I do appreciate that. John, it looks like you raised your hand. If you're on the phone line, feel free to press #6 to ask your question. If not, I will keep going through the Q&A pod to see if your question is there. Or John just mentioned that if the plan must include a lot of acronyms, try a table of acronyms next to the table of contents rather than using parentheses throughout the document. That's definitely a good suggestion. I know that some of our CIPs also go ahead and have the acronyms spelled out on the pages throughout the document, too. So if it's an acronym that hasn't been used in a while, they can go ahead and explain what that means on the page that the acronym is actually on. Kay, I don't know if you have any tips for using acronyms as well.
I like the idea of having it next to the table of contents, but I guess just limiting them as much as possible is a good way to avoid having to have a glossary of that nature.
Great. And then going back to the discussion of color, Sherry, one of our RPMs that we love as CICs, also mentioned that color can be tricky because the information may make sense in black or may make sense in color but doesn't make sense in black and white. So I really encourage you to either work with the graphics designer or work with other folks in your office to make that black and white version print out and be accessible for your audience, whether it's using different fonts, different grades of color, like if you're using graphs and tables. There are lots of tricks that you can use for the grayscale version to make sense just like the color version would. Just print it out and give it to someone and make sure it makes sense for them. Someone mentioned, Kay, and you might be able to speak to this, that sometimes CICs might refuse to use acronyms and spell out a term every time. And, you know, if you're using a term only one or two times in the document, there's really not a reason to use an acronym unless you're trying to educate the public on the acronym that's going to they're going to hear over and over again for the next 20 years. But, Kay, I don't know if you have any suggestions on, you know, whether or not we have to use acronyms.
Well, I think we certainly don't have to use acronyms, and, of course, you want to sometimes read some of these documents out loud to see how awkward it might be to spell something out every time. But frankly, I think that spelling things out, you know, as much as possible is a kindness to the community because they're not going to be familiar with our acronyms, and they may well use acronyms differently. They may have their own three-letter acronyms that they use for, that stand for something completely different. So it'll sort of impose confusion in the document. So I think it's valid to spell things out as much as possible. And remember that, you know, there are going to be times when your audience is reading information that's kind of going to stress them out. So you want to give them things, you know, that are simple and straightforward and, you know, that they don't have to continually refer to, you know, a glossary table or definitions or something like that. So just kind of keep that in mind. You know, as we said at the very outset of this presentation, you know, once you know your audience, you'll have a better idea of how to write for them.
And, yeah, great. Knowing your audience is really important. Someone mentioned that sometimes acronyms really need to be used. Parts per million, you know, it's really helpful for people to see that written out, parts per million, and explained in plain language terms. We like to use PPM because we all know what it means, but remember your audience may be the first time they've heard it, and they need to see it written out a few times before they start kind of understanding what we mean by that term.
Exactly. I mean, when you see the phrase parts per million, it creates a picture in your mind, but PPM doesn't. So for people who aren't technically experienced or, you know, are going to have a hard time understanding, that kind of information, spelling it out so that it gives them a picture of what we're talking about could be very helpful.
And then one more thing before we move on to kind of summarize the content in the webinar is Pamela asks, how often should a CIP be updated over the life of the site? I think this is an excellent question. And Pamela, we talk a little bit about this in our CIP tool that you can download and look at. But really the answer is it depends on the community, and it depends on the community engagement plan that the site team wants to take for the site. For those who don't know, a community involvement plan should be in place before the remedial investigation starts. So that's early in the process. We recommend that it should be updated at particular milestones in the site, like a record of decision has been issued, or we've completed construction, or we're going into a five-year review period. You know, think about whether it makes sense to update the community involvement plan. If there's large changes in the community, whether if people moved in or out and the community looks a lot different than it did when the community involvement plan was created the first time, that would be a really good time to think about whether it needs to be updated. And also a reminder that the NCP does state, the National Contingency Plan states that site teams should think about whether or not they need to revise a community involvement plan when the record of decision is signed. So there's two times that we're legally required to think about the community involvement plan. One is before remedial investigation starts, where you actually develop the community involvement plan. And the next time is when the record of decision is signed, and you need to decide whether or not you need to revise the community involvement plan. Do you have any other thoughts on that, Kay, on keeping the community involvement plan? It should be a living document.
Exactly, and I think you've covered all the points. You know, because some of these Superfund sites are ongoing for decades, it's very helpful to think about, you know, every so often, you know, when it's practical, to, you know, reread and revise and, you know, and even go back out and interview the community again, especially, as Yolanda said, if the community has changed a lot over time.
And then one of our RPMs also mentioned that it's kind of odd to revise the community involvement plan after the record of decision, you know, since a lot of our community involvement activities are really heavy pre-record of decision. And I agree with that. If the CIP is dusty and it's been a long time and yet you're going through the proposed plan and you're trying to get community comments and feedback, you know, really think about revising the community involvement plan before the ROD is issued. I do appreciate that comment. So we've had about 15 minutes left in the session, and I encourage you to keep the questions coming. We'll try to get to those at the very end, but we just wanted to take some time to review the material that we went over today, because we have gone over a lot of material. So first, we covered the main purpose and audience of a community involvement plan, and also for other documents that we write for communities who are affected by Superfund sites. I'm going to ask you all to participate in this summary of what we've learned today by answering the question, who is the main audience and what is the main purpose of your written documents for the site? And this is a training tool to try to remind you what you've learned today in the last hour, and it'll help you kind of use the techniques that we've presented to you and keep making your documents better documents. So some answers rolling in right now. Go ahead and ask everyone to participate in the poll. The main purpose and audience of documents are the community. Anyone on a cleanup site team? Yes, I agree. RPMs, OSCs, CICs, our lawyers, our toxicologists, our tech support. The document does speak to them as well. We've got some more answers rolling in. The public, the entire site team, the affected community, the community to inform them and engage them, absolutely, involved and impacted community. And remember that your community is not necessarily just people who live on the site or right next to the site, but anyone who might come to the site or frequently be there or be impacted by the site's activity and cleanup. So they are your audience as well. Great, well, let's go ahead and move to the second part of learning outcomes, which is to organize effective public documents. Please participate in the poll and let us know what is one organization method that we covered today that you're going to take with you. Message mapping, absolutely. That is one organizational technique that we talked about today. And keep those answers coming in. Focus on your audience. That's one of the things that we've talked about. Organization. Using appendices for supplemental information. Lots of different organizational techniques. And some people are also noting the formatting techniques that we've talked about today, too. And we'll cover that a little bit more. Cover page that pops. Use of layouts, tables. You know, everyone's just putting everything that we went over today, so that's great. Use of white space. Keep them rolling in. What are some organizational and other techniques that we've covered today? Active voice. And again, some people have a really hard time with active voice, and Kay found this great video that's in the related URLs pod at the bottom link, and it kind of takes you through explaining active versus passive voice, and I encourage you to take a look at that video if that's a technique that you feel you're having some problems with. Use of white space, use of tables, parallel structure, keeping language simple, using space around text and margins. Yes, it's much easier for people to read, whether it's online or it's printed out on a document. That's great. A lot of answers coming in. You know what? I think we'll go ahead and we've got great answers on not only how to organize a document, but formatting techniques that we talked about that enhance the scannability of documents. And also some people pointed out good writing techniques that we went over today. So I really, you know, I think we can close this part of the webinar. I really appreciate everyone joining and being part of those learning outcomes that we summarized today. And I'll go ahead and give it to Kay to do the final closeout of the webinar.
Thank you, Yolanda. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to present with you. And thanks to all of you who participated in this webinar. I hope you found it valuable. Plain writing and clear storytelling is an essential value that we can provide to our projects and to the communities that we work with. And I'd be happy to answer questions offline about effective writing for communities. Thanks again.
Now I'd like to remind everyone to please complete the full feedback form we have by selecting the additional resources link in the related URLs pod at the bottom corner of the screen. Or I think I can open it right now, too, to force you all to look at it and do it. You know, we spent a lot of time putting together these trainings, and we're trying to use this new form of Adobe Connect, and it's really helpful to know if it worked for you and what we could do differently that would make it more effective next time. So we do look at all of the responses that you provide, whether it's helpful tips to do things different next time or just letting us know that we did a good job. And we really do appreciate it because we put a lot of time and energy into the webinar today, and we want to make sure that that's an appropriate use of our time and energy and that we should continue doing this in the future. So please take a moment to fill out the evaluation for us, and also a reminder that we have a quick tip sheet that you can print out and keep at your desk for reference. And you can find that in the related URLs tip sheet at the bottom right of your screen. And it's just a Word document that you can print out and use for you anytime you'd like. Great, we've got some thank yous. Thank you for participating. And Kay and I are here if you have some more questions and want to type that into the Q&A pod. Feel free, and we'll be here for a few more minutes. And Heriberto, you raised your hand. I don't know if you're on the phone, you can press #6 to ask your question or have your comment, or you can type it in the Q&A pod and we'll try to respond to it. I've got lots of things typing in, so I'm trying to get to them.
Yolanda,
and thanks
while you're
again, everyone.
Going through those, just one final reminder, we do occasionally get requests for training certificates or for records for those EPA staff members who are trying to earn credit or document their participation. At this time, we don't necessarily issue training certificates. However, if you fill out that feedback form that Yolanda's referenced, there is a box you can check. It's circled in red on this last slide, As long as your email address is entered correctly and you check that box, once you submit your feedback form, we will send you a confirmation email, which at least verifies you shared feedback after the live event. Usually, if you keep a copy of your registration email, the slides, or the seminar homepage along with that confirmation email, that's usually enough to document your participation and earn credit with whatever accrediting institution you're using the webinar access for. And that also applies to those of you who are replaying the archived version. You can still share feedback based off the recorded version and receive one of these confirmation emails.
Thanks, Jean. And I know someone opened the feedback form, so it should be open on everyone's screen. So we do really appreciate the time that you would spend evaluating the session today and letting us know how we did. And we have a couple more questions rolling in, so we'll just stay on the line. Thank you for everyone who participated again, and understand if you need to leave. Someone just mentioned, it's about time that we made use of the effective writing techniques to communicate with communities. I agree, Rita. So hopefully you can use some of the tips and techniques that we talked about today. Okay, do you see any other questions popping up?
You know, I'm paging through them, but I'm not sure that I can quite figure out what I'm looking at.
Okay, no problem. I'm looking through them too, and I don't see any additional questions. So I think we will kind of close out the webinar today.
Sounds good. And like I said, I'm more than happy to answer questions offline, so please feel free to send me an email. And I'm sure Yolanda feels the same way, and we'll help in any way we can.
Great, absolutely. Thanks again, Kay.
Thank you, Yolanda.
All right, have a good one.
Bye.